I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, the minority view on stimulus spending. Some economists are clamoring for more government spending, but Neil Ferguson says it won't work in today's global economy, and we'll get his view. But first, to that plane crash in suburban Buffalo. Officials in Erie County in upstate New York say it's remarkable that that Continental commuter plane didn't take out the whole neighborhood when it crashed into a single home last night. All aboard and one on the ground were killed, and one of the victims was Beverly Eckert, whose husband died in the terrorist attacks on 9/11. After his death, Beverly became one of the leading voices of 9/11 family members, a force behind the formation of the 9/11 Commission, which ultimately forced lawmakers to pass sweeping reforms of the U.S. intelligence system in 2004. Beverly was also a Buffalo native and was on her way home to attend a celebration of what would have been her husband Sean Rooney's 58th birthday. Well, Carrie Lamack joins us now. Carrie's mom also died on 9/11. She was a passenger on board a plane that was hijacked after leaving Boston's Logan Airport. And Carrie also became a 9/11 activist. So, Carrie, first of all, we're so sorry for your loss.
Thank you. It's been a very tough day, and I think we're all in shock, not only, obviously, having lost a good friend and someone who I've gotten to know so well over the last 7.5 years since our loved ones were killed, but obviously, the manner in which she was tragically lost is just incredibly shocking. There just aren't words to describe it.
Right. It does seem, horribly unfair in addition to everything else. Well, tell us more about the work that Beverly Eckert did.
Well, even listening to the introduction you gave, it made me smile because we spent a lot of time together in the last 7.5 years, and it took us 14 months to fight for a 9/11 commission. And then after the commission was finished and its recommendations came out, we spent the fall of 2004 literally every week from September to December, except for Thanksgiving and election week. We were down in Washington together and alongside some other 9/11 family members. And I remember vividly when we sat in the observatory watching the House of Representatives vote on the bill, and I sat next to Beverly, and we just held hands and cried because we couldn't believe that we had finally, at that point, more than 3 years after her husband and my mom had been killed, we were finally getting government to make changes that we've been asking for so long. And it was a really special moment and one that I was proud to share with Beverly.
Well, and this crusade of hers and yours came, with some criticism, although it's unimaginable to others, but we just feel we should remind people that commentator Ann Coulter, for instance, was one who accused people like Beverly Eckert of, doing all of this to just try to benefit from their husband's deaths.
Well, those people didn't know Beverly and didn't know the people that I was lucky enough to work with Beverly. I mean, none of these people were doing this for personal gain. And if you knew Beverly, in fact, I've been working on a project to prevent nuclear terrorism, and Beverly has recently gotten engaged in that. And we, just in January, we're having conference calls to discuss, okay, what are we going to do about this now? The funny thing about that was we all know how cold it was in January, and Beverly was at a Habitat for Humanity site building a house. So we'd be on these conference calls, and Beverly, you could almost hear her shivering. She would do the calls in a place that had no heat.
Well, she was on her way to her hometown of Buffalo because her late husband was her high school sweetheart, and their high school is starting a scholarship fund in his honor. She was to be part of that ceremony. And she also recently was at the White House to talk to the new president about his thoughts of, closing Guantanamo Bay. How much will her voice be missed from some of your ongoing concerns?
Well, there's no replacing Beverly. I mean, one thing about her is she, once she put her mind to something, she was going to make sure it happened. And I was just a few minutes ago talking to another 9/11 family member and saying, okay, how are you going to make sure that Beverly's voice continues to be heard? And I think that we'll take that on as our mission and our honor to continue to honor her, because she is such a wonderful woman, and I think that we're just all in shock right now. We just can't believe it.
Yeah. That's Carrie Lamack. She lost her mom on one of the planes that was hijacked on 9/11 and now has lost her friend Beverly Eckert, whose husband died in the World Trade Center that day and was a leading voice for the families of 9/11. Carrie, thanks again for speaking with us, and again, we're sorry for your loss.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Well, it could take all night, but Congress is expected to pass the revised stimulus package today. The package will pump $790 billion into the economy. About 35% of that money will go to tax breaks, the rest to spending. And some economists are saying that's not enough spending. Remember 1930s economist John Maynard Keynes, every dollar spent will reap a dollar and a half in economic output. Spend more. Well, economic historian Neil Ferguson is not one of those voices. He says those in favor of big spending have regressed to their macroeconomic childhood, clutching their economic theories like an old teddy bear. They need to grow up. Neil Ferguson is a professor at Harvard Business School and a former advisor to John McCain. His latest book is The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World. He's in the studio with us. So, Neil, don't hold back. How do you really feel about the economists backing spending?
Well, I think it's naive to expect the kind of multiplier effect that Keynes talked about. A multiplier effect is that boost to stimulus over and above the expenditure that you initiate. The assumption that the Keynesians make, and Nobel laureate Paul Krugman is in the vanguard of this, is that there is really quite a big multiplier out there. So for every dollar, you're going to get at least 125 or even 130 of additional economic growth. And this is just illusory, and they know it.
Okay, let's go over some of these things here. First of all, Keynes, British economist who told FDR, don't worry about deficits, spend your way out of the Depression. And by the way, since you are an historian here at Here and Now, we also like to mention that Mormon from Utah, Mariner Eccles, who went and told FDR the same thing and, you know, spend your way out of the Depression. What are you saying? Are you saying spending didn't work then?
No, spending had some effect then, although the deficits were relatively modest in the 1930s. One shouldn't exaggerate the scale of the Keynesian policies that FDR adopted. The interesting thing is that the deficit we're looking at this year could be of the order of 13 or 14% of gross domestic product, because remember, the stimulus package comes on top of an already huge deficit inherited from the Bush administration. That is more like the deficit the U.S. ran in World War II. So I would say this is World War economics without the war. In World War II, the economy was effectively closed, and the stimulus went directly to American manufacturing industry and indeed to cutting-edge technology. The U.S. economy leapt ahead in World War II. That was the ultimate stimulus package. It practically doubled the gross domestic product of the U.S. But we're not in that situation today. The crucial point today is that you're launching an enormous deficit on a globalized economy. The United States is an open economy. That means there are all sorts of leakages that can happen. In other words, it isn't going to do a whole lot for American employment if people do take their additional money from the government and spend it in Walmart on Chinese imports. The other point, of course, and this is really crucial, is that people may simply save any additional income that arises from the stimulus package. People are really pessimistic in the United States at the moment. They've been told by two successive presidents that they are on the brink of economic catastrophe. And not surprisingly, I think their response is to say, well, I'm going to save anything that comes in case I lose my job, or I'm going to try and pay down debt.
Well, you said a lot here, Neil Ferguson. You mentioned Paul Krugman. This is very aggravating for Americans, because we are hearing Paul Krugman say that there isn't enough spending. He's writing, the American economy could produce more than $30 trillion worth of goods and services in the next 2 years, but if there's no one to buy that stuff, there's going to be a huge gap, and that's what the spending money in the stimulus will close, that gap, by putting money in the hands of Americans, that they will spend that money.
Well, there's absolutely no guarantee that they'll spend it. And what Paul Krugman isn't telling readers of the New York Times is that this is a quite different crisis from the Great Depression. This is a crisis of excessive debt. We've come through an age of leverage which saw the debt-to-GDP ratio in this country rise to 355%. So total debt, public and private, in excess of 3.5 times the GDP of the United States. The idea that we can solve this problem with more debt by piling on another $2 trillion of debt, and maybe beyond that, another trillion in 2010, is completely implausible.
Well, the argument is that this time around, as opposed to other times that Americans have been handed money and did indeed, you know, pay off their credit cards, that this time around, the money in the stimulus package is going to be given out to single people around $400, married couples around $800, but not in a lump sum. It's going to be given in a few dollars each paycheck. And we hear analysts like Clint Stretch of Deloitte Tax say that there are Americans who at the end of the week only have about $20 after expenses. If they had another $20, they might go out and get a couple of pizzas, or they might go out and go to the movies.
Or they might go out and spend it in Walmart on Chinese manufactured imports.
And that's where your argument that this is not a closed economy, that the money goes out of the country. So what would you do? Do you say do nothing?
On the contrary, there are far more radical things that need to be done now that are being postponed. One is a real root and branch restructuring of the banking system. A great many important banks are, to all intents and purposes, insolvent, and we're drip-feeding them taxpayers' money in the hope that somehow they'll pull through. This was the mistake the Japanese made in the 1990s,
the zombie bank problem. Zombie banks, banks that are just sort of limping along. You say the government shouldn't bail out these old dinosaur banks. Are you saying let them fail?
No, they need to be restructured. That is a polite way of saying nationalized, temporarily taken over. The equity holders, the stockholders need to be wiped out. These banks are bust. The bondholders, the people who are owed money by the banks, basically need to take a haircut of around 20%. The depositors are fine. They need to be protected. That's clear. That's already a legal commitment. But the banks are basically insolvent and they need to be restructured. They're not going to suddenly turn around and start lending because their balance sheets are essentially a disaster zone. And they keep getting worse. This is a critical point. Every day that stock market prices fall, every day that real estate prices fall, the position of those banks deteriorate. So number one is a real restructuring of the banks of the sort that the Swedes engaged in their banking crisis in the early 90s.
But you make a distinction, I think. When you say restructuring, you say it's just a polite way of saying nationalizing, but don't you also mean restructuring has an end game to it?
Well, the hope would be that within at least a 10-year time frame, they could be reprivatized, having been cleansed of their toxic assets. They could be put back into the private sector. A more important point is that we mustn't do anything that prevents the formation of new banks. We also need to make sure we do nothing to prevent the formation of new financial institutions.
In other words, don't give these old banks unfair advantage over new banks.
We don't want a situation in which we keep them alive, but we give them privileges because they're state guaranteed that can't then be enjoyed by competitors. So that is really a critical part of the solution. And so far, from what I can see, Secretary Geithner's plan does not go nearly far enough in restructuring the financial system.
So you and others are thinking of, in your word, restructuring, as you say, it's a polite word for nationalizing the banks. Americans have long been against that, you know, anything that feels like socialism. But do you think that that may be changing now?
Well, I think it's a myth that Americans are against state ownership of certain utilities. When I go to New York, I'm very often on a train operated by Amtrak.
Well, and there's a lot of criticism of how Amtrak's run.
But it still provides a train service. I call this the Bank of Amtrak problem. That is to say, what is currently Bank of America, a notionally private entity that I think is insolvent, is going to end up being the Bank of Amtrak. In other words, we won't love it, but it'll deliver a basic service to people who want to deposit money and have checking accounts and make basic loans, take out basic loans. That's the future for these big monster banks that basically blew up. We can't allow them to die. They're too big and they provide too many functions. But we've got to take them over and restructure them in such a way that they can actually function, because right now they're not functioning. Right now they're just large holes which public money goes into and lies in a pile.
Neil Ferguson, Harvard University economic historian, and as he says, a minority voice on the stimulus package. But he says spending in this day and age won't work. When we come back, we want to ask, what about building roads, Neil? What about creating jobs? We'll have some more time with Neil Ferguson. And later today, for Valentine's Day tomorrow, lovely love songs from Oscar Hammerstein. That's later today. Back in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with historian Neil Ferguson of Harvard University. He's going against the tide of economic opinion by saying that New Deal-like government spending won't work in this day and age. Also that the government should temporarily take over failing banks and restructure them. And Neil, you also say that more important than any of this is that mortgages need to be refinanced so people can afford them. Tell us more about that.
The reason that Americans feel pessimistic at the moment is primarily that they're all heading for negative equity. That is to say, a great many households are already underwater, their debts exceed the value of their homes, and with every passing month, the number goes up because property prices are falling at an annual rate of nearly 20% with no floor in sight. And nothing in the stimulus package addresses that problem.
Well, and the president has said he's going to announce his housing plan down the road. It's not yet been announced.
Well, this is to do things in the wrong order. We need to do something quite radical to try to stabilize the monthly payments and all those adjustable rate mortgages that are really at the heart of this crisis. And postponing that seems to me to be another recipe for an ongoing crisis.
It does seem also to be acquiescing to, as you call them, the dinosaur banks. they don't want to, you know, renegotiate a lot of these loans. They're going to get less money.
Right. That's why these two measures go hand in hand. Restructuring the banks, telling them, guys, it's over. You, the management, failed. You're gone. Stockholders, I'm sorry. You invested in lousy companies. You're gone. And at the same time, you're able to restructure the mortgage market and deal with this fundamental problem, which, as I say, is at the heart of the crisis, the problem of excessive indebtedness and, in some cases, spiraling interest payments. And remember, Robin, there's an absolutely crucial link here. As the US government splurges with expenditure, runs a huge deficit, there is likely to be upward pressure on interest rates. That's what happens. If you flood the bond market with new bonds, then long-term interest rates go up, and that means mortgage rates go up. So the fiscal policy has negative implications for monetary policy. We are seeing a collision between two different approaches to this crisis.
Neil Ferguson, I just want to make sure I've heard you right. You're against the spending and the stimulus package. You say the country's way too much in debt. It's not a closed economy the way it once was in FDR's time. Even if consumers spend money, it goes to China because it's on products from outside the country. But what about the other spending in the package? Expanded unemployment benefits, people who have been out of work for so long, food stamps, construction of highways and bridges, they're falling. But also this would create jobs, water treatment facilities, high-speed internet service, all these ideas of, moving the U.S. into a better economy, but also create jobs along the way. Doesn't spending create jobs?
Well, my analogy with World War II is really important here. One of the interesting things about the way the government spent money in the World War was that it devoted quite a lot of it to cutting-edge research. We're not really doing that at the moment. We're drip-feeding money into various things that have a degree of political appeal. Because remember, this whole bill was outsourced to Congress in an extraordinary step in the direction of parliamentary government by President Obama. And not surprisingly, people in Congress did what they could have been predicted to do. That's to say, they took the invitation to spend $800 billion and they asked themselves, what's in this for me politically?
In my state, yeah.
Right. So I think the result is not something that is going to have the kind of dramatic effect the Keynesians predict. I'm not saying they shouldn't do it. That's to say that there are many things in this bill that are defensible, particularly when it comes to targeting money to the very poor. The key is not to expect there to be a big macroeconomic benefit. People are going to be deeply disappointed in the consequences of the stimulus package. A year from now, we'll be wondering, where are the 3 million jobs you promised us, President Obama, because they're not there.
So I'm guessing, the answer to my next question, how do you think Obama is doing? The answer would be not well.
Well, I have huge admiration for President Obama as a politician. I was won over by him last year. Having been an advisor to John McCain, I was simply overwhelmed by the quality of his performance in the debates. And I also felt that he, more than John McCain, had a sense of the magnitude of the financial crisis, and he deserved to win. But what worries me about what he's done since entering the White House is that he has, to some extent, delegated too much power to his own party in Congress. This is almost like watching prime ministerial politics in Britain. I was in Washington this week at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and I was wandering around thinking, why does this feel familiar? There was all sorts of manic activity to do with the stimulus package, as you can imagine, in the corridors of power. And I thought, the reason this feels familiar is it feels just like being at Westminster in London, where the parliamentarians, the legislators, are calling the shots. They're determining what this bill is going to be. They're determining how the money is going to be spent. And where's the president? He's not even in town.
Well, backers of Barack Obama would say the same thing, only from a different point of view. They'd say he gave way too much to Republicans calling for tax cuts, and he's not spending enough. And it goes back to the spending. And
well,
they're disappointed.
If there's going to be any immediate stimulus, it will come from the tax cuts, not from the government expenditure. No doubt about which works fastest, though I'm skeptical that even that will have much effect. Interestingly, they would be much more encouraged, I think, by reductions in their mortgage payments, by a fundamental downshift in mortgage payments, than they're going to be encouraged by tax cuts, because most people are going to look at these tax cuts and say, well, this looks like a temporary measure. A government that's borrowing $2 trillion this year is going to be coming back pretty soon, asking for higher taxes. And that, I think, is another reason why people won't be rushing out to spend this stuff.
Well, Neil Ferguson, it's funny because here you are, as you said, you were an advisor to John McCain. You're very concerned about maybe too much spending or the thinking that spending is going to have an immediate result in the stimulus package. Some people might see you, kind of moving to the right side of the bench. But then here you say banks need to be taken over, restructured, another word for nationalized. Republicans would, hate that. Who are you?
I'm not an orthodox conservative. I'm a historian. And as I show in my book, The Ascent of Money, time and again in financial crises, the state has to step in. Because markets are prone to malfunction, not least because of human psychology and our tendency to swing from one extreme, greed, to the other, fear. Throughout the history of financial markets, the role of the state has been crucial, not just as a regulator, but sometimes intervening to stabilize the system. So for me as an historian, it is absolutely unsurprising that in a crisis of this magnitude, government has to step in. The question is, how does it step in? And I'm simply against the naive view that all we have to do is play the old Keynesian cards of the 1930s, stand back and expect a recovery. It's much more serious than that, and it requires structural changes to address the problem of excessive indebtedness that got us into this mess.
That's Neil Ferguson, a professor at Harvard Business School. His latest book is The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World, no less, with what really is the minority view on spending in the stimulus package. We'll see how it plays out. Neil, thanks so much for weighing in.
My pleasure.
Okay, Monday on Here and Now, former presidential candidate George McGovern reflects on Abraham Lincoln. Also, look at the online phenomena, 25 Things About Me. What are people revealing about themselves? And more important, why? That's Monday. Still ahead today, why did Judd Gregg abruptly jump the Obama ship, turning down a cabinet post? Back after the news, Here and Now. The Israeli military is reporting that two rockets launched by Gaza militants hit a communal farm in the town of Sderot today. On the Palestinian side, medical authorities are reporting that hours after that strike, an Israeli airstrike in Gaza killed one man and critically wounded another. This, even as there are reports of a possible Egyptian-mediated truce between Israel and Hamas. And in the background, the recent Israeli elections, which have left that country in political limbo, with nationalist and right-wing parties holding the critical swing votes needed to form a new Israeli government. What does all this mean to Dr. Mustafa Barghouti? Dr. Barghouti is a Palestinian doctor and opposition leader. He ran for president of the Palestinian Authority. He's long argued for a nonviolent Palestinian response to Israel. He's in the States, so we thought we'd get his opinion. Dr. Barghouti, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
And what do you take from the Israeli election?
Well, unfortunately, this has not been only a move to the right. It's more than that. It's a move towards extremism in Israel and towards racism, I would say. Because if we look carefully, both Kadima and Likud, which are the two main competing parties today, come all from the same origin, which is extreme right wing. And these parties, plus the racist parties in the new parliament, consume about 80% of the seats in the Israeli Knesset. That is worrying.
Well, let me ask you a couple things off of that, because as you well know, there are Israelis who would say, well, wait a second, it's Hamas, the radical militant group leading Gazan Palestinians. It's Hamas that's racist. They're against Israelis and against the existence of the state of Israel. And it's only because Hamas was firing missiles into Israel that Israel had to protect itself. Palestinians in the West Bank, led by the PLO, are working towards a two-state solution.
Well, first of all, even if your neighbor is racist, supposedly, if it was a racist, and I don't agree with that analysis either, that is not a justification for you to become racist. That doesn't hold. But on the other hand, let me clarify one point. For a whole year, Abbas in the West Bank had the authorization to negotiate with the Israelis. And during a whole year of negotiations, what Palestinians got is more expansion of settlements. We had 520 military checkpoints cutting the West Bank into pieces. Now we have 699, more than before. The expansion of the wall continued. The issue here is this vote in Israel, where a person like Lieberman, who's nothing but a neo-fascist, this man got the highest vote among young students in a demi election, is indication of something risky. I feel sorry, and at the same time, I worry about what's happening to the Israeli society. As if this is a message from the whole Israeli society to Palestinians that there is no place for peace and no place for coexistence, not only with Hamas, but no coexistence even with Palestinian moderates.
You mentioned Lieberman. Avigdor Lieberman is the leader of the Israel Beitanu party. It's an ultra-nationalist party. It's asking that Arabs living in Israel swear an oath of allegiance, among other things. But what about those who've said, and we heard this on our program, that maybe it would have to be a hawk that would lead Israel to peace, you know, much as Nixon was the conservative who could open China?
You know, I've heard this argument so many times before, and it's not valid. Sharon did not produce peace. He produced massacres. And when it came to Gaza, he produced unilateral action that led to disasters. He refused even to negotiate with the so-called moderate Palestinians. What worries me about these elections in Israel, that it happens exactly at a time when we are about to lose the last opportunity of two-state solution.
Well, I want to mention that even the most conservative of the candidates, Avigdor Lieberman, is for a two-state solution, but obviously his other statements have...
Well, he's not for a two-state solution. They speak about two-state solution, but they mean Bantustanization. They mean creating Bantustans, like has happened in South Africa, when you had under apartheid regime puppet governments under the control of the apartheid system. And that's exactly what Israel is trying to do. If we are to live under apartheid, we have no choice but to struggle against apartheid. And that's what I advocate, nonviolent struggle, like the civil rights movement in the United States for equality, like Gandhi did in India.
What do you suggest the struggle look like? I'm trying to picture it.
I am suggesting something like the civil disobedience movement that prevailed in the United States at one point of time. And it might take time, but that's our destiny.
But do you envision sit-ins, marches with arms locked, without weapons?
We are doing that already, yeah. We are doing that. We march peacefully against the building of the apartheid wall, which is cutting our country into pieces. We march against these checkpoints that prevent us from reaching our work or reaching our hospitals.
Can you organize a bus boycott? You know, I'm just trying to apply some of the thinking.
Yes, there is a call for boycotting products in Israel and a call for divestment of Israeli products. And I think that's a fair call because with that sort of economic pressure, the apartheid system was broken in South Africa. And that's what Palestinians call for today.
By the way, what do you expect from the Obama administration?
You know, when he was elected, the day he was elected, the first name that came to my mind was Martin Luther King. And I thought, this man who gave up his life for the sake of freedom of his people can now rest in peace because what he struggled for maybe has been achieved. And all the values that Barack Obama spoke about in his inauguration speech touched my heart. Freedom, justice, equal opportunity, respect of human rights, respect of democracy, respect of Fourth Geneva Convention, not accepting torture. And that's the challenge, in my opinion, that is confronting Barack Obama. Can he bring the agenda of change, not only to economy, not only to Iraq, but also to Palestine? If there is a country that has leverage over Israel, it is the United States. And that's why I say these elections in Israel put in front of Barack Obama an immediate challenge that he cannot avoid.
Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, a Palestinian doctor and opposition leader who's now in Washington, D.C., visiting before going home. By the way, I'm just curious, do you know Dr. Izzeldin Abulaish?
Yes, of course. I know him and I know of his story, poor man.
This is the Gazan doctor. Many have been following his story. He studied in an Israeli hospital. He speaks Hebrew. He considers himself a peace activist and friends with the Israelis and lost three daughters who were shot and killed by Israeli tanks. His brother was also killed, one of his other daughters severely wounded. I heard him saying to Robin Lustig on the BBC, I mean, this man who's lost so much, who never thought the Israeli tanks would fire on him, the Israelis saying that they were aiming at Hamas fighters on his roof and admitting it was a mistake. He said that what has to happen is love. Your thoughts on that?
I believe this man is an honorable man, and he did not let his personal pain affect his views, and that is to be respected. I think what he's saying, we should not allow hatred to dominate our life. But I would say also that love is good, but it's not enough. We have to have love. We should not allow hate to dominate our life, but we have to struggle for peace. Without struggle, peace does not come.
Dr. Barghouti, thanks very much.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
Well, of course, the question's still unanswered. What, if anything, can Palestinians do about Hamas rocket attacks on Israel? And we'll, of course, continue to follow the internal civil war between Hamas and Fatah. You're listening to Here and Now. Many Americans don't know what the Commerce Secretary does, and many didn't know New Hampshire Senator Judd Gregg's name until last week when he became President Obama's second choice to lead the Commerce Department and the president's third Republican cabinet nominee. But so much for bipartisanship. Senator Gregg withdrew his name yesterday, citing irresolvable conflicts. Well, what's really behind all of this? Peter Walston covers the White House and national politics for the Los Angeles Times. And Peter, even though Gregg downplayed it, you say this might really be about the census. So draw those dots for us.
Okay. Well, first of all, there's a chance that we actually don't yet know what this is really about. So there was enough mystery last night and enough conflicting stories coming from White House officials that this may be a mystery that
we never get solved.
The answer to. Right. So, but I'll, based on the facts we do have to go on, there was a big blow up over the U.S. Census, which. If most Americans haven't heard of the Commerce Department does and haven't heard of Judd Gregg, they definitely don't realize that the census can be a matter of political bickering. But it's actually an incredibly political process because the results of the census are used to determine to draw district boundaries for congressional districts and state legislative districts.
Sure.
And the people who do that are state legislators. And it is, I've covered it before in the Florida legislature, it is the most partisan process that exists in all of politics.
Sure. There's a huge debate over how the census is taken. And apparently, I'll just synopsize some events here. Minority groups complained about Judd Gregg's nomination because he once voted to abolish the Census Bureau. And they were worried that he wouldn't do the census the way they want it to be done, which is statistical representation rather than a direct headcount. Now, this is the long-fought battle, as you said, between the two parties. And in response to the complaint of these minority groups, the White House released a statement. Now, what did they say?
The White House said that they were going to work closely with the Census Director. Now, the way that this was interpreted by some groups, including conservative Republicans, that in essence, White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel would be directly supervising the census. Now, Rahm Emanuel is an innately political person.
He's known as Rambo.
He is. He was in charge of House campaigns when he was in the U.S. House, and of course, those campaigns are all about how the districts are drawn, and the districts are drawn based on the census. Important to that, of course, is how minorities are counted, because that has a direct impact on how many districts are Democratic and Republican, and how many minorities go in each district. And the parties are all every 10 years. That is the source of the fighting between the two parties in state capitals all over the country.
So Republicans fear that Rahm Emanuel is now going to take this over. They hold a press conference yesterday, threatening a lawsuit shortly after Judd Gregg withdraws. Did he realize that he might be in the position of, you know, fighting his own party?
Well, I can't get inside Judd Gregg's head.
Oh, come on.
certainly he knew when he took the job, when he accepted the nomination as Commerce Secretary, he knew that the census came under the supervision of the Commerce Department. He knew that he would be working for a Democratic administration. These are all things he knew. In fact, he even talked about one reason that he began having trouble with the job is that he was uncomfortable with the economic stimulus package. Well, he also knew that that was going on when he took the job. So it's very unclear exactly what finally got into Judd Gregg's mind that led him to withdraw. But what we do know is that over the course of the time since he had been nominated, Republicans were really ramping up their objections to the whole political fight over the census was blowing up. I mean, minority groups had complained, and Republicans were fighting back, and he was suddenly caught in the middle of that. And clearly was not comfortable with it, and probably, I'm only speculating here, probably was feeling a lot of pressure from his fellow Republicans to not be somebody who would be in the position of defending the White House direct supervision of the census.
Right, on something such a hot topic. Peter Walston, national political writer for the Los Angeles Times. We can, you know, speculate on this one, and thanks for helping us do it. Thank you.
Happy to do it. Thanks, Robin.
Well, coming up, the songs they apparently are not singing in Washington, the love songs of Oscar Hammerstein, after a break, here at Now.
C
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back.
Some enchanted evening, you may see a stranger. You may see a stranger across a crowded room.
Ezio Pinza singing Some Enchanted Evening from the original version of Rodgers and Hammerstein's South Pacific, with, of course, music by Richard Rodgers and lyrics by Oscar Hammerstein. And if it sounds impossible, well, Oscar Hammerstein actually did meet the love of his life one enchanted evening, a stranger across a crowded room on a cruise ship to England. And on the eve of this Valentine's Day, we thought, why not live for a while in Oscar Hammerstein's world? Our guest, Amy Ash, has just edited the complete lyrics of Oscar Hammerstein II. Amy Ash, welcome.
Thank you so much.
And, well, thank you for this beautiful coffee table compilation. But we know that some of our listeners just ran screaming from the room because, while this music is adored by many, it's also been called saccharine, you know, a ridiculously optimistic view of love that led Americans to believe falsely that they would see their true love across a crowded room. I mean, hasn't there been sort of a turning at times on Oscar Hammerstein?
Sometimes people think that he is a little too sunny, but an example is the current production of South Pacific here in New York that shows some of the darker side of human experience. Hammerstein said, yes, he was an optimist. Yes, he believed in people, in humanity, but that being a realist meant that you had to acknowledge that there were two sides and not just dwell on all the things that are wrong.
And even though they might have been seen, you know, in the Vietnam era as maybe a little treacly, when Rodgers and Hammerstein in particular first worked together, they were seen as revolutionaries.
Yes, they were revolutionary in terms of the stories that they told in music and dance. Also in the structure of their play, they were much more interested in telling a story than having standalone beautiful songs or standalone jokes. They wanted everything to meld together.
Well, Hammerstein worked mostly with Rodgers, but he worked with many others, Jerome Kern. Let's listen to If I Loved You from Carousel. Tell us what's happening in that song.
Well, the two characters, Billy, the barker for a carousel, and a young mill worker called Julie, just seen each other across the fairgrounds and thunderous chemistry. But it's early in the play and they have scarcely exchanged any words together, so they can't quite acknowledge the momentous thing that just happened. They're not going to say, I love you madly. They're going to say, well, if it happened that I loved you, this is what I would try to say. This was what I would want to say if I loved you.
And that's a musical also that has tremendous darkness.
Oh, yes. There's a suicide.
Yeah.
Many of his shows do have death and sorrow as well as the sunshiny, happy songs.
And fear and ambivalence, as you were just saying, you know, in If I Loved You. And also in Can't Help Loving That Man from Showboat. Let's listen.
Fish gotta swim. Birds gotta fly. I gotta love one man till I die. Can't help loving that man of mine. Tell me
your thoughts on that piece, Amy.
Oh, it's a thrilling song to sing, and it washes over you when you hear it. But I wanted to point out that in Showboat, it's established in the script that this song is only known to people who are black. And when the white leading lady on the showboat starts singing it and knows it all the way through, that's a hint that she's not who she seems to be. And in fact, the sheriff comes very quickly to arrest her for being married to a white man.
There were so many loves that crossed ethnic and cultural lines. I'm thinking, too, of The King and I.
It's heightened because Anna and the King, although they're attracted to each other, there's never going to be any romantic relationship between them. She would have to be willing to be one of his many wives and concubines, and I don't think that she would ever stand for that. Besides, she's devoted to Tom. She sings about it in Hello, Young Lovers, that she's had her love, and she's happy for the younger people to get the experience that she had.
That's right. She said, I've had a love of my own, and now it's time for you. Actually, let's listen a little of that. A little bit about the way Hammerstein used lyrics. I mean, every sentence didn't have to rhyme. What makes a Hammerstein lyric?
Well, that's a good observation, that he was not a brilliant over-the-top rhymer, and he felt that it could sometimes distract from what the character is saying. He worked very hard to make sure that the words that came out of the character's mouth suited the character and not just the author. He wanted to be sure that it was the right vocabulary, even including dialect, for a person of a certain era and a certain education, a certain class. He wanted every part of the experience in the theater to continue the story.
Well, earlier you mentioned the revival of South Pacific with a new Broadway cast that's getting rave reviews. It's with Paolo Schott and Kelly O'Hara as Emile DeBeck and Nellie Forbush. Let's listen to Paolo Schott as Emile singing This Nearly Was Mine. And first, tell us the context for this one.
Oh, well, Nellie has rejected him because she had learned that he had been previously involved with an island woman and there were two mixed-race children, and that was just shocking to a girl from Little Rock, Arkansas. And he has a beautiful song about what might have been.
One dream in my heart, one love to be living for, one love to be living for, this nearly was mine.
Oh, it's heartbreaking.
Not only women can sing the torch songs.
Yeah.
I hadn't until just this moment thought about it, but that is a song of, you know, where did my love go? That's a torch song.
Well, there are so many other love songs written by Oscar Hammerstein. We're thinking of Do I Love You from Cinderella. Do I love you because you're beautiful? Are you beautiful because I love you? And he's spoken about this.
Every show that he wrote, and he wrote about 60, has to at least have one love song to begin the show or to have at the first act curtain and a song of separation. He worried a bit about running out of new ways to do it.
But let's listen to his conclusion.
Just as you think that it's been said in every possible way, someone else or you yourself find another way of saying it. But that's one of our problems. You sit down and you're writing a new show and you have two characters who love each other. And their problem is, how will they say this in a way that hasn't the audience won't think stale?
Do I love you because you're beautiful? Or are you beautiful because I love you?
Amy Ash has edited the complete lyrics of Oscar Hammerstein II. It's a beautiful coffee table size. Amy, thanks so much for doing this and for speaking to us about it.
Oh, thank you.